This is Audible.
Defiance Audio presents Simon R. Green's Deathstalker War. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Nanette Savard, Colleen Delaney, and Terrence Aselford. Special guest performer, Christopher Graybill. Episode 3, Innocence Lost. They called it Shannon's World because it was his dream, his vision. He all but bankrupted himself bringing it into existence, but the result was a pleasure world like no other, reserved only for the very rich, the extremely well-connected, and the strictly aristocratic. Its location was a secret known only to the glamorous few. For those inquisitive others who bribed or bullied their way to Shannon's world uninvited, state-of-the-art security and weapons systems waited to blow them out of this world and into the next. Shannon's world, where mountains sang to each other, fantasies and dreams became real, and the whole world was alive. A pleasure planet unlike any other, where even the weariest of souls could find rest and comfort and contentment. And then the awful thing happened. Afterward, Shannon's world cut itself off from the Empire, refusing to acknowledge any form of contact. Visitors were destroyed while still in orbit, no matter whom they represented. The Empress sent a ship. It never came back. She sent a star cruiser, which managed to land a full brigade of Marines. Something killed them. So she tried a series of covert security teams. Only one man returned from what had been the foremost pleasure planet in the Empire. He came back, soaked in many people's blood, quite mad, his mind destroyed by what he'd seen, and died soon after, mostly because he wanted to. He renamed the planet Aseldama, the Field of Blood. The Empress put the planet under quarantine, stationed a star cruiser in far orbit to make sure whatever was down there didn't get out, and then turned her attention to other things. Thanks to the traitor Deathstalker and his growing rebellion, she had far more pressing worries than a pleasure planet gone bad. And so things might have remained, if the most important strategic and military mind in the Empire, one Vincent Harker, hadn't crash-landed on what used to be Shannon's world. In his head was information vital to both the Empire and the Rebellion. The Empress sent down a company of her elite battle troops to recover him. They never reported back. Now, it was the Rebels' turn. In a hastily converted cargo ship called the Wild Rose, a small group of Rebels watched the sensor panels closely and hoped the new Haydenman cloaking system was everything it was supposed to be. The planet's defenses were powerful enough to batter down any force shield generated by anything less than a full star cruiser, and the cargo ship's shields were strictly rudimentary. Either the Haydenman device fooled the orbiting satellites, or the Rebels wouldn't live long enough to know they were dead. The device squatted behind them, roughly bolted to the deck, all sharp edges and unexpected angles, with strange lights that came and went for no apparent reason. The Rebels preferred not to look at it. The shape of the device hurt their eyes. They kept their gaze fixed on the sensor panels in the main view screen, watching the planet grow slowly beneath them, cool and blue, and utterly enigmatic. On board the Wild Rose was Finley Campbell, the aristo-turned-rebel, daredevil fighter with a coldness in his soul, who had once been secretly the masked gladiator, undefeated champion of the Golgotha arenas. At his side, his lady love, Evangeline Schreck, daughter of the aristocracy, who lived for years with the secret that she was really only a clone, created to replace the daughter sexually abused and murdered by her father. On Finley's other side, Julian Skye, the rogue Esper rescued by Finley from the interrogation cells under Golgotha. Skye was once one of the most powerful Espers in the Empire, and a daring rebel. But his time in the blood-stained hands of the Mind Techs had left him hurt and damaged, perhaps beyond his ability to recover. And finally, there was Giles Deathstalker, the legendary hero who'd spent over 900 years in stasis, emerging to find an empire he barely recognized. Rebels, one and all, representatives of the Golgotha Underground, desperate to find Vincent Harker before the Empire forces did. Also along for the ride were Toby Schreck and his cameraman Flynn, heading toward a story darker and stranger than they had ever known. Finley stirred impatiently at the sensor panels. He'd never handled waiting well. His only prayer had always been, "Dear Lord, please deliver me into battle and danger up to my eyes." He had once been a master of fashion, a fop and dandy of great renown, a persona and mask he'd created to hide his secret other existence as the masked gladiator, fetid darling of the arenas. Now he was on the run from the society he'd once moved in so freely, just another rebel among many, expendable enough to be sent on what many regarded as a suicide mission. He was 26 years old and looked easily 10 years older. His long hair had faded to a yellow so pale it was almost colorless. He wore it tied back in a single, practical pigtail. He had the look of a mercenary soldier, cold and dangerous, but essentially uninvolved. He only joined the rebels to better protect his love of Angeline, and made no secret of his distance from the underground's politics. It was enough that they provided him with missions where he could test his courage and skill with weapons. Finley Campbell was fast becoming that most dangerous of men, one with nothing left to lose. Only Evangeline kept him sane and focused, and both of them knew it. Evangeline Schreck had lived most of her life in fear. Fear of being exposed as a clone and executed for the unforgivable crime of having successfully impersonated an aristocrat. Fear of her father's perverted love. Fear of always being alone. And then she found Finley, and for the first time in her life, she had a reason to go on living. If he died, she didn't know what she'd do. Unlike Finley, she had no taste for danger and excitement, but as a clone, she was fiercely dedicated to the rebel cause. And if the many tensions of her life were slowly tearing her apart, that was her business. Gammon and Elfin, her military fatigues hung about her like a tent. She had large, dark eyes a man could drown in, a firm mouth, and the unmistakable air of a survivor, of someone who had lived through pain and horror and despair, and had not broken under them. Yet. They stood together, studying the bright blue planet on the viewscreen before them. There were no signs of civilization, nothing to show that humanity had ever made a mark on Shannon's world. No cities, no great roads, nothing big enough to trigger the ship's sensors. Whatever lived down there was keeping itself hidden and secret. Evangeline sighed suddenly.
Oh, it looks so innocent, untouched by man, not at all like a field of blood. What could have happened down there? What terrible thing to justify such a name?
Finley smiled slightly.
Something powerful and nasty enough to kill off every armed man the Iron Bitch has sent down there so far, and there's not much that can stand against a full force of armed marines. I've always liked a challenge.
Do you think... could it be something like the Grendel alien? I've seen the hollow of what that creature did at court.
Unlikely.
Toby spoke from the back.
After the horror of what happened on Grendel, every planet in the Empire was searched for signs of more vaults. Not even a pleasure planet like this would have been exempt. And if anyone had found more sleepers, there's no way they could have kept it quiet. There isn't that much money in the Empire.
Don't worry, love.
Finley put an arm across Evangeline's shoulders and pulled her close.
Whatever's down there, I'll protect you. Just as a matter of interest, how did we get the coordinates for this place? I thought they were strictly need-to-know, only issued to actual visitors.
Valentine Wolfe supplied them. Before he left us to become Lionstone's right-hand man. Apparently he'd been here once, but didn't care for it. Something about the place disturbed him. He thought we should blow it all up.
The Wolf.
Finley's lips curled back in something between a snarl and a smile.
I must find him and thank him personally. And then I'll cut his heart out and hold it still beating in my hand. He destroyed my family, betrayed the rebellion, and spat on everything I ever believed in.
Be fair. We are, after all, talking about Valentine Wolfe, famed for degeneracy in a court where the appalling and the disgusting have become commonplace. I'm amazed you people let him into the underground in the first place.
He had money and contacts, at a time when we needed both. Besides, he came with good recommendations.
Who from? The Royal Guild of Chemists? If you nurse a viper in your bosom, you shouldn't be surprised if it turns around and bites you.
I will kill him. No matter where it takes me, no matter what it costs.
Sometimes I can't help wondering if we're getting too inbred. Here we are, about to face unknown dangers on a planet known as the Field of Blood, and all you can think about is dueling someone who's light years away, and probably permanently out of your reach anyway. Give me strength.
You wouldn't understand. It's a matter of honor.
Of course not. I'm a journalist.
In his short career, Toby Schreck had shown a remarkable talent for being in the right place at the right time and producing excellent coverage of extraordinary events, first on Technos 3 and then on Mistworld. His reports hadn't made him any friends among the powers that were, but his ratings were going through the roof. Toby was quietly very proud of this. During his early career, cleaning up after Gregor Schreck's messes, he'd often dreamed of being a real journalist, covering real stories. Now that he'd got his chance, he was living his dream. And if he got uncomfortably close to having his ass shot off on more than one occasion, well, that came with the job. He grinned at the image of Shannon's world on the view screen. He would be the first journalist ever to set foot on the legendary dream world, and the first to tell what had gone so horribly wrong there. Life was good sometimes. Just in front of Toby, staring blankly at the view screen, was Julian Skye. Toby didn't quite know what to make of the young Esper. He'd been handsome once, apparently, before the Imperial interrogators went to work on him. They'd done a lot of damage to his body and his mind before Finley rescued him. Most of it had healed, but the broken bones of his face had mended lumpily, and parts of his face still hung slack from damaged nerves. He wore a rather obvious wig to hide the steel plate covering the hole the mind techs had made in the back of his skull, so they could work on the brain directly. Before his capture, he'd had a reputation in the underground as one of their wildest, most daring operatives. But his time in the torturer's cells had destroyed his bravado. And while he hadn't crawled or broken or betrayed anyone, he was haunted by the certainty that he would have eventually. Finley had rescued him just in time, and Julian had clung to him ever since. He didn't feel safe when Finley wasn't around. Finley, to his credit, had tried to discourage this, building up Julian's courage and confidence when he could, but the Esper's hurts ran deep, and he constantly found excuses that would keep him close to Finley. He even argued his way into what everyone said was a suicide mission, just to be with Finley. It wasn't clear yet what Evangeline made of this. Toby kept an eye on all of them just in case. There was a story there just waiting to happen, and he didn't want to miss it when it finally broke. He also kept a careful, if inconspicuous, eye on Giles Deathstalker. The first and greatest of his line, first warrior prime of the Empire, 900 years ago, who had wielded the Dark Void device and put out 1,000 suns in an instant, leaving their inhabited worlds to wither and die in the sunless cold and dark. Billions died in horror and despair because of one man's decision. Giles was tall but sparsely built, though his arms bulged with muscle. He dressed in battered furs and leathers like a barbarian, and wore his long gray hair in a mercenary scalp lock. He looked to be in his late 50s, with a solid, lined face, his mouth a thin, flat line above his silver-gray goatee. His eyes were a surprisingly mild gray, but his gaze was firm and unwavering. He looked hard and uncompromising, a vision from the past, when the Empire had been a proud and honorable enterprise, served by proud and honorable men. Giles Deathstalker, greatest hero and greatest traitor of his own time, who would not yield then or now to anything that might compromise his sense of honor or duty. Giles Deathstalker scared the shit out of Toby, who didn't care who knew it. Toby looked back at the mysterious planet growing steadily on the view screen. He found it less disturbing.
You people know more about Shannon's world than I do, but according to rumor, it was supposed to be very restful down there. No worries, no pressures, almost therapeutic. A place where you could forget your cares and misfortunes. According to the records, there were 522 people down there when whatever happened, happened. None of them have been heard of since.
But what could possibly have gone wrong on a pleasure world? There was nothing there that could hurt them, and we knew they were protected from outside attack. The planetary defenses are still working.
We're getting past them.
Giles grunted suddenly and sat forward in his chair, catching them all by surprise.
Pleasure worlds. Just another sign of how pampered and soft the Empire's become since my day. You need hard-driven people to keep an empire strong. We had pleasure worlds in my day, but they were places you went to test your mettle and your courage. Valhalla's where you could fight and feast and battle to your heart's content. Or at least for as long as your heart could stand it. No mock battles, either. They were the real thing. That was the point. You could die on a Valhalla if you weren't as strong or as skilled as you thought you were. The weak died and the race grew stronger. There was no room for weakness in humanity then. We had an empire to forge and protect. Now you sit in your seats at the arenas, watching other people fight and die, and get all excited at the sight of a little blood. No wonder the Iron Throne's corrupt. The blood's become thin, and honor is just a word.
Not to all of us.
I don't mean duels over hurt feelings, boy. I mean honor you live your life by. A cold and inflexible master you serve before family or throne or personal need. A duty you carry till you die, or you break under the weight of it. I gave up everything I had or ever dreamed of to follow where duty led. Can you say you'd do the same?
I don't know. I don't suppose anyone ever knows till the moment comes. But I'll do what's necessary, and damn the cost. I always have.
Do we have to be so gloomy? Let us not forget, people, that however our mission goes, we all stand to become extremely rich. The networks will pay practically any price you can think of for exclusive eyewitness accounts of the mysterious Shannon's world. We're going to be rich, I tell you, rich.
Or dead,
said Flynn without opening his eyes.
We are not here for the money.
You speak for yourself.
Julian Skye listened to them argue, but had nothing to say. He didn't give much of a damn about Shannon's world or its mystery. He was only here because Finley was. And besides, he had his own worries. His headache was back again, a thick, thudding pain that he could hardly think past. The pain and the disfigured face were the least gifts of the Imperial Mind Techs. They'd opened up his head and put needles in his brain, and now he wasn't who he was anymore. His courage was broken, and certainty was gone. And what remained was less than a shadow of the man he had once been. The Mind Techs were very good at their job. Their procedures were advanced, secret, binding. There was no way of telling what they had done to his brain, what secret commands might have been planted in his mind. When vicious pain had driven all hope of sleep from him and reduced him to helplessness and tears, Julian wondered if he was dying slowly, inch by inch. When the pain was really bad, he wished he could. But eventually the pain would pass again, and then he would cling to the few motives he had left that kept him alive. He still believed in the rebellion, and he believed in Finley Campbell, the man who risked all to come and save him. And so Julian followed Finley wherever his missions took him, proud to be in his company, and perhaps hoping a little of the man's courage and certainty would rub off on him. He took a little pride in the fact that they made a good team. He wasn't sure how he felt about Evangeline Schreck. On the one hand, Finley obviously loved her with all his heart, so she must be a remarkable and worthy woman. But on the other hand, Julian was ashamed to find he was sometimes jealous of her closeness with Finley. He pushed the thought aside and gritted his teeth against the pain in his head. The others mustn't know. He had a mission here, and he would not be found wanting. He still had some pride left. Finley trusted him to carry his weight, and he would rather die than disappoint the Campbell. He made himself concentrate on what was being said. Giles was still talking. Now there was a real warrior. There was no room in such a man for doubt or weakness. He was the Deathstalker, a warrior out of legend and out of time, when men and deeds were bigger than they were now. A man like that would break before he would bend, and die before he would break. And who could kill a legend? Giles drew his sword, laid it across his knees, and polished the blade with a piece of rag from his belt. He found the slow, steady movements of his hands comforting and reassuring. Something that never changed. As far as he was concerned, this whole mission was a waste of his valuable time and skills. He was a fighter, not a spy. But even he could see the value of the information in Harker's head, and so reluctantly he agreed to the Underground's request that he join the team. All the other Maze veterans were needed elsewhere, and there was no one else he could trust to protect the team from unknown dangers. Besides, he felt a need to prove his worth to the Rebellion. Being a living legend was all very well, but just because you had been a strong man in earlier times didn't necessarily mean you could still pull your weight. Trust didn't come easily in the Underground. Charles approved of that. And deep down, he couldn't help but wonder if he was still the man he remembered being. He'd been in stasis for a long time, and the universe had moved on without him. And he didn't trust the changes the Maze had made in him. He didn't know their extent, or even if he could depend on them. This mission would give him valuable opportunities to test his skills and his strength before the real fighting of the Rebellion began. He had no doubts about his courage or determination. He was, after all, a Deathstalker. Giles had always felt most at home on the battlefield, where ambiguous questions of politics and loyalties resolved themselves in the clear-cut choice of life and death. Causes might change, ideals might rust, people might betray you, and love and faith and friendship might let you down. But in battle, there was only a victor and a loser, and that was the way Giles liked it. Toby fidgeted uncomfortably in his seat. He wouldn't be happy till he was safely down on solid ground again. Everyone knew this was the most dangerous and uncertain part of the mission. Theoretically, the Haydenman cloaking device should conceal them from Haseldama's orbiting satellites. But if it failed, even for a moment, the planet's defenses would open up, and they were all dead meat. And if that wasn't problem enough, since Shannon's world was officially quarantined, it was under constant guard by an orbiting Imperial Star Cruiser, with orders to open fire on anyone or anything unauthorized. Hopefully, the rebels had a way around that.
Hold on to your seats, everyone. If everything else is on schedule, things should start getting interesting right about now.
They all strapped themselves into their safety webbing and watched the view screen intently. For a moment that seemed to stretch forever, nothing happened. The Imperial Star Cruiser hung in orbit, not all that far away, blind to the rebels' presence, huge and intimidating, and bristling with gun turrets. And then, a great golden Haydenman ship dropped out of hyperspace right on top of it. Vast and magnificent, it dwarfed the Star Cruiser. It opened fire with all its guns. In the Imperial craft, force shields flared and spit on the brink of overloading. The Haydenman ship then turned and moved gracefully away. And the Star Cruiser set off after it, grimly determined to deny Shannon's world to the old enemies of humanity. And as the Empire ship began its wild goose chase, the converted cargo ship dropped silently out of orbit and headed down toward Haseldama, the Field of Blood, and the horrors that awaited them there. For long moments, everything was still and quiet, and the rebels began to relax. But then they plunged into the atmosphere, and the ground-based defenses opened up on them, hammering at the small craft's shields. Finley ranted and swore, stabbing at the sensor panels, trying to boost the cloaking systems as best he could, while his webbing swung back and forth. But something down below had seen through the Haydenman technology, even though that was supposed to be impossible. The cargo ship rocked violently as deadly energy streamed around its shields, probing for weak spots. The rebels clung to their crash webbing as Finley wedged himself against the control panels and fought to guide their descent. The lights snapped off for a moment, replaced by the sullen red glow of emergency lighting.
What the hell happened to the cloaking device?
According to the systems, it's still working. But it didn't exactly come with a guarantee, you know.
Now he tells us.
The ship lurched to one side. The emergency lights flickered.
Outer shields just went down. Systems now running at 70% efficiency. Anyone know any good prayers?
Can we shoot back at them?
We don't have any guns. There wasn't any room with all the extra Haydenman systems. Didn't you listen when they were briefing us?
Obviously not closely enough.
One of the control panels exploded into flames. Finley flinched back from the heat. The cargo ship dropped like a stone before backup systems cut in. An alarm sounded, harsh and strident, until Finley hit the off switch. They already knew they were in trouble. The flames were leaping higher. Smoke began to fill the cabin. Evangeline released herself from her crash webbing, grabbed a fire extinguisher, and trained it on the fire. The wallowing craft threw her this way and that, making the task almost impossible. Finley fought for control with the surviving instrumentation. At the back, Flynn was quietly getting it all on film. And then the barrage stopped, as suddenly as it began, and all was quiet, save for the crackling of the flames. Evangeline quickly snuffed them out as the craft righted itself, and then she stood and listened, braced for more attacks.
They've stopped. We must have fallen below their programmed response limits. People, I'd say we just got very lucky.
That's the damage, said Julian.
Could be worse. Nothing major's gone down. We can still land and take off safely, assuming the ground defenses only fire at craft coming down and not those leaving. But you should stay in your crash webbing anyway, people. Landing's liable to be a bit bumpy.
Check for comm traffic.
Finley nodded and bent over the comm panels. It only took him a few moments to eliminate the comm signals from the departing Star Cruiser and concentrate on the planet below. The comm computers ran up and down the frequencies and found nothing.
Not a damn thing. No one's talking to anyone down there. The whole planet's silent.
Giles nodded slowly.
Try the sensors. Check for life forms.
Finley moved over to the sensor panels, waving away smoke that drifted in front of his face. He ran a quick diagnostic and frowned. 43% efficiency. Not good. Limited range, and even more limited information. He set the sensors for the widest remaining range, and then watched the displays with a deepening scowl.
I'm getting something, but don't ask me what. I'm getting readings, but they don't make any sense. I can't tell whether they're life forms or not. The computers can't find anything in their records to compare them with, which is supposed to be impossible.
Aliens?
Unknown. But I don't think so. Even the most alien life form should conform to some established pattern. Whatever these readings are, they're swamping the sensors. If there are any humans down there, the sensors aren't sensitive enough anymore to pull them out of all this noise.
Or there could be no one left. Harker's been down there for months now. Anything could have happened to him.
Think positively. What about his ship's beacon, Finley?
Well, that's still there. I'm locked onto it, loud and clear. Should be able to put down right next to it.
Well, that's something. Anyone think to bring any beads or trinkets for the natives?
There aren't any natives. Never were. Shannon's world was a dead rock floating in space before it was terraformed. There are no indigenous life forms. They would have gotten in the way of Shannon's carefully crafted dream. Whatever's down there, no, it isn't natural.
Finley, put us down, fast as you can. That Star Cruiser isn't going to stay distracted forever.
I came on this mission at the last moment. Do we have time for a quick briefing on what we can expect to find, Dirtside? I know the basics, but, well, the field of blood doesn't exactly fill me with confidence.
There isn't that much real information. Only one man ever got off this planet alive after whatever it was that happened here. He renamed it Hesaldama before he died. Whatever he saw down there destroyed his mind. He wanted to die, to escape from what he'd seen.
I have a copy of the man's original statement. Just the relevant points. He tended to ramble. I acquired a tape from a colleague, for a purely nominal price, which I'm sure the underground will take care of, once they find out about it. Shall I run the tape?
Run it. It might stop some of us from getting cocky.
Toby nodded to Flynn, who accessed the ship's comm channels through his camera, and then had the camera run the tape in its memory banks. The main view screen shimmered, and the bright blue planet below was replaced by a man's face, wild-eyed and sweating, and so painfully thin that the bones of his face seemed to be pushing out against his skin. He'd been strapped to his chair, apparently as much to hold him up as anything. When he finally spoke, his voice was harsh but even.